Dr. Google can't fix your knee. The Joint Relief Institute can. Fast joint pain relief, covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
All right, let's go. Wake up in the booth. All levels set? Ready for professional podcasting? If there is such a thing? Yeah. Oh, he points at me. Yes. The talent, always ready. Whenever there's a hot mic, whenever there's an on-air sign lit up, yeah, talent is ready. All right? Cool. Got the intro music ready? Write it in the book, episode 131, about to be created before your very eyes. You don't even understand what you are witnessing here every time we do the podcast, do you? You know, you just move on to another thing, but this is history. So let's make some. Ready? 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. Right here at WGNPlus.com. A new episode is posted every morning for your podcasting pleasure. Welcome aboard. And so, we begin with episode 130. Wow, some people thought it would never even last 3 episodes. And here we are at 130. No, 131. 131. And I know that because if you go to the landing page on WGNPlus.com and you go to the entertainment section and you hit the Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic prompt, you will see all 130 previous episodes, meaning, of course, that this is episode 131. Welcome aboard. We appreciate your loyalty and your scrolling or clicking or swiping or whatever it is you do to find us on a regular basis. Hopefully you do tune in every week so there can be a little sense of intimacy or an immediacy. I know that in the podcasting world, that's the whole thing, is that it's entertainment content at everyone's convenience. That's the big difference between, say, terrestrial radio, the radio you hear on your radio, and a podcast, is that radio over the air is on at a certain time, but podcasts can be listened to at any time, and there are advantages to both, certainly. What I miss most about being on the radio and on a regular basis is the ability to interact with you, the audience. Immediately, as things happen, you reacting to something that I've said or something that I've done or vice versa. So that aspect is not there on a podcast, but certainly the convenience side is for both of us. I record these whenever I have time as opposed to a specific time period, and you can listen to them at a certain time period. Or at any time period. So, yes, we have, as I've said many times with technology, we have certainly altered our behavior and altered our lives by our own convenience. We are no longer tethered to what the man says. So won't you listen to what the man says? He said, boo doo 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 doo. Yeah, I mean, before, you know, the TV show was on at 7 o'clock at night on a Tuesday. You had to be there at 7 o'clock at night on a Tuesday to see it. And obviously, 30-some years ago, with the introduction of the VCR, that changed things. And now with the DVR, that changed things. And then another layer of of change, of course, happens now with the streaming. And your Netflix and your Amazon Primes and your Hulus and all your other streaming services. Now you have complete seasons available where you can just binge whenever you want. You know, before there was cable, and that was an alternative, but you were still tied into a time slot. But yeah, we have certainly become a culture of convenience. We like our convenience. And I guess there are some positives to that. But I do miss and enjoy the immediacy and the urgency and the intimacy of live radio. And that's what really first attracted me when I was a little kid. I used to call into radio shows all the time, whether it was to request a song. Early on was just requesting a song. And then it was, as talk radio became more popular, calling in and mixing it up and with the actual host. And that was really through that where I really caught my, I caught the bug, if you will. And then it's been an itch and a bite that has never gone away. And I have been scratching that itch as much as I can, and I continue to scratch it. And so here we are today. And I bring this up because it does play into what I wanted to talk about today in terms of my own itching and scratching. And I mean that in a non-medical way. I just mean it in terms of my own interests and goals and ambitions. And a lot of people say, you know, I mean, I've always loved to talk, as I said, as I've always talked about. I always did well in school with my report cards. But if there was always one drawback to my report cards, you know, on the behavioral section, there were the grades at the top for arithmetic and social studies and science and all those things. And I always did very well. But then, if you remember, at least on my report cards, underneath, there were these little behavioral things on there. And that was to say, well, you know, everything's fine, but, you know, doesn't listen or not paying attention. You know, these were little behavioral things that the teacher then would notice and mark so that, you know, maybe your parents could say, hey, look, you know, you're getting your grades, but there's all these behavioral things. So the great irony was that I had always had excellent grades. And thanks to my mom, the Rat Pack, she wasn't in the Rat Pack. No, my mom was not Frank Sinatra. Hey, baby, here's your lunch. Hey, here's your cuckoo homework. Take it to school with your consent form. No, that was not my mom. She was a pack rat, not a Rat Pack. Hey, razzmatazz. No, she was a pack rat. And I still have many of my grammar school, original grammar school, and even in many high school report cards. But the grammar school ones were the ones where they wrote in little stuff on the bottom as far as behavioral things. And because by the time I went to high school, the report cards were computerized. So it was just basically, you know, the letter grades. But in grammar school, there was the letter grades or the number grades, whatever they used for at your particular school. And then there was, as I said, this behavioral area. And I always got talks too much. Always got talks too much. Jim is a pleasure to have in class. He's always ready to volunteer, to help, and, you know, all these nice little things to say. However, he does like to talk a little too much. And so here we are, you know, 40, 50 years later, still talking. And that was basically when I decided what to do with my career. I said, well, if I talk too much, I might as well find a way to make a living out of it. I guess to some extent I have. At least I used to. But I'll tell you, one of the, you know, it's not easy. You always hear about people dreading public speaking. people, you always hear these studies that, you know, people just, one thing they fear the most is public speaking. Now, I don't know, that used to be a result of a lot of polls that with people, what do you dread the most? But in today's world, with the cell phone and the selfies and everybody posting themselves, their photos or their videos on YouTube or Facebook Live and all these other, I don't know if that's the case anymore, to be honest with you. That may have been the case many years ago, because there was a time when the average person was not so out there. People were much more private. And talking in public was something that a few people did or looked forward to. But in today's world, where narcissism abounds, in the, you know, everybody talks about we're in a Me Too, culture right now in terms of the sexual harassment, and that's true. But I think for a longer time, ever since the introduction of the iPhone, which really changed our behavior, we are in a look at me. There's always a me in it, if you notice. We're definitely a me culture. In the 70s, used to call it the me decade. They felt that people were too preoccupied with themselves. In the 70s, 40 years ago, that's nothing. This is the me century. Forget about decade. Whenever there is a hashtag, it's always got a me in it, doesn't it? Don't you notice that? There's always a me something. It's blank blank, hashtag me blank, or hashtag blank blank me. The me is always there. We are a narcissistic society, folks, and that's just what it is, and we have to deal with it. And I believe that the cell phone, not so much the cell phone, but the iPhone, giving people both the power of a computer and the convenience to put it in your hand, in your pocket, in your purse, is just too tempting. It unlocked our natural narcissism, which always lived beneath the surface for most people. It's just that there was a time when it wasn't socially acceptable to brag or to be conceited. That was a big word. You're conceited. Conceit. These were always a negative personality attributes. Going back to the time of Shakespeare and beyond, you hear Shakespeare write about it. Those were not attributes, personality attributes that were supposed to be exalted in our society. You were supposed to work on those. You should not be conceited. You should not say, look at me. You should not want a spotlight on yourself. But those were natural urges. They are in our DNA, I believe. And I think the iPhone, given what it's was able to do, what it, its power to say, hey, and these applications, you know, Facebook and selfies and Twitter and all these things, it was begging for people to brag about themselves, to show themselves, look at me, 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 me. I really do think that that comes from the generation of the last 30 years, certainly, when all the parenting books talked about instilling your children with self-esteem. And I think we've gone overboard. And so that's why the millennials, the 20-somethings and the 30-somethings, had to invent these applications that fed that narcissism. Because after they were leaving the house and they were not getting that self-esteem boost every day from their parents or even their teachers, everything you do is great. You are great just because you are you. That was kind of the bubble that people were raised in the last 30 years. When they got out into the real world, no one really cared about them. They weren't getting that positive reinforcement from everything they did and everyone they met. And so, with the power that the iPhone allowed and enabled, they created apps that allowed them to get daily, minute by minute, hourly self-validations, self-affirming, self-esteem building types of messages from the world to keep feeding that beast, which they were raised in. You know, that's the first generation that was really raised in that kind of constant complimenting. So there's no question why people, when they got older and they went out to the outside world and people didn't, the outside world did not care. They had to find a way to make the outside care world. Why do you think on Facebook it's like, right? You hit the like button. That means a lot. You are liked. That's a positive word. A view is okay, but like. You want to know why Mark Zuckerberg is so rich? Because of that one word on Facebook, like. That's what appeals to people. They get likes. They like likes. And I won't lie to you. I mean, look, as I said, I'm sitting here talking to myself, basically, right? I'm hearing my own voice. Hopefully there's others that will hear this later, but as I record this, I'm just talking and hearing myself talk, right? That's narcissism. I'm the first to admit it. Yeah. You know, I've got a big ego. I enjoy talking and sharing my views. As I've said many times, this idea of being on the radio, the ego that you have to have, and I readily admit it, as I've always been very honest with everybody, and I've always been very honest on the radio and very honest with whoever listens to me. This is not an act. I readily admit, yeah, huge ego, have to have an ego. You know the ego you have to think that you, when you talk, other people find you interesting? Okay, now times that about going on the radio, putting yourself out into the public. It's one thing to be in your own little group and you sort of lead the conversation and you're the class clown or you're the guy that tells the jokes, whatever that may be. But wow, it takes a huge ego to decide to do that on a format that amplifies and brings your voice to potentially millions of people, whether it's on television or the radio. That's a huge ego to think that I am worth or worthy of speaking and have others listen to me. Yeah, I readily admit that. I'm under no delusions here. Or illusions. No, delusions. No, I fall into the category. It's just that when I was growing up, there weren't as many of me's around. Now, as I said, there's a whole generation of me's. Everybody's me in terms of, but yeah, that takes a huge ego to sit there with this microphone and hit that on switch, especially when you're on the radio and that's going out live and you are expecting on a daily basis for people to tune in. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with it, and I'm grateful that people find me interesting and do want to listen. But my point is the ability or the thought to do that, it does take a huge ego. No question about that. But and even here on the podcasts, you know, to sit here and talk for an hour or so every week in the hopes that people find what I talk about interesting, yeah, that takes a certain amount of ego. So I'm not innocent in this. I'm just saying that now we have a whole culture of that. Before, there was only a small pocket of people that did it. Now, that's why we had to create the internet and all these applications, because everybody wants to say, look at me. I use that look at me phrase because I learned it when I heard an interview with the great actor, one of the greatest actors of all time, Sir Laurence Olivier. And many people may have heard his name. I don't even know at this point if many people have. Google that. Laurence Olivier, if you've never heard of him. He was one of the greatest actors of the 20th century. And one time they asked him, well, why did you start acting? You know, what is it about acting? Why did you want to be an actor? And of course, you know, they're looking for some profound answer from him. About, you know, the usual, oh, it's great to become another person, or it's great to explore the emotions of the human being and try to recreate them. And it's great to make a connection and use your own personality and your own emotions to connect with the audience. There's so many high-minded reasons why actors use or say as to why they are in acting. And what I loved about what Laurence Olivier said, it was so easy, so simple, so basic, and so true. They said, "Sir Laurence Olivier, why did you want to become an actor?" And he said, "Simply, look at me." It's not more complicated than that, folks. Look at me. When you see or read or interview with an actor and they talk about why they're acting, that is it, those three words, that's it. Look at me. And that's what we're in, a look at me society. That's what I said before. But yeah, look up Laurence Olivier. The guy was a great actor as well as, and he didn't BS anyone. I love that answer. Look at me. And as I said, I am not above it. I say look at me and listen to me. I act. I've probably been in about 40, more than 40 plays now in the last 15 years when I started acting. Look at me. As I always joke when we're in rehearsals and they're beginning to do the lighting, or at the beginning of the process, they call it blocking, and that's where you are supposed to stand. You know, whenever you see an actor move around the stage and stop at a certain point or move at a certain point, that is not by accident. That is rehearsed. That is planned out by the director. And so that's called blocking. And very often when we're in the early stages of rehearsal, the director will say to me, we'll walk over here because there's going to be a light right here. And so, you know, walk into that light. And I always say, oh, don't worry. I will always find my light. Meaning, if there's a spotlight somewhere in the distance, somewhere around, oh, I will go to it. I will gravitate to it. Don't worry about that. I always joked about a microphone. If there's a live microphone, I am attracted to it like a moth to the flame. I have no, as I said before, no delusions. I know exactly who I am and what drives my engine. And that's something that I wanted to talk about. So I'm giving you a little background here, because the main thing I wanted to talk about, and all this leading up to it, as you will see, there is some method to my madness. This may sound very haphazard, but if you listen with any regularity, you'll know that somehow I find a way to tie it all together. So I'm giving you a little background here, and now we get into the meaty stuff. Thanksgiving. This is Thanksgiving week. As this podcast is posted, this week is Thanksgiving. And, it's no great observation. I'm not the first to say it, obviously, that we have just steamrolled over Thanksgiving now for a good 20-some years, if not more. And now, I mean, you know, ever since that Black Friday event started, I mean, Christmas has really began to encroach on Thanksgiving. And I remember as a young kid, Thanksgiving used to be and have its own importance and its own uniqueness. It really was a major holiday when I was growing up as a kid. But I really believe in the 80s, that started to go away for some reason. Especially, probably most likely because in the 80s, in the mid-80s especially, there was a huge economic boom. And that's where the term yuppies came from. Young urban professionals. That's what a yuppie is or was. So basically, it's a young person who lives in the city who's, got a good job and has some disposable money to spend. They don't have a family yet. So they've got some disposable money, and so that's when they go out and they buy nice clothes, or they buy nice gadgets, or they buy nice cars, or they live in nice apartments, and that's where the whole yuppie term came from. Young urban professionals, yups, yuppies. And now I think that's just called millennials. Oh, I always pick on the millennials because I love the millennials. Anyway, So there was a lot of disposable income, and so I think that's when the rush for that almighty dollar in our capitalist society, you know, Christmas, you know, the department stores, the retail stores could not wait for just, you know, December to be their selling time. Usually it was, you know, that's why Black Friday is traditionally the day after Thanksgiving, because it's like, okay, we can have Thanksgiving and then but then it's a rush to Christmas, and most people have the day after Thanksgiving off, so it makes it for perfect. So that's where the perfect storm for Black Friday came in, with terms of all these sales and all these people lining up and all these coupons and all this, you know, these melees and these riots at stores to get cheap televisions and cheap blenders or whatever it is. And to really be honest, I would think that if we did a cultural thing, once again, I think it does date back to the 80s in terms of the buying frenzy. If people remember the Cabbage Patch Kid, that was really when this idea of buying frenzies started. There's always been a rush on different toys and different gifts, especially around the holidays, especially around Christmas time. There has always been a rush, and things do get sold out. But when the Cabbage Patch Kid was introduced in the mid-80s, that's when the idea of fighting people for this doll sadly became commonplace. And I think the idea of people going to stores and being in a blind frenzy. Oh, I can honestly say I've never been to a Black Friday, and that's fine if you go. That, and some people make a day of it, and that's great. They make a family outing of it. That's whatever rocks your boat. I've never been that into shopping where, you know, I would do that or want to do that. When I go to the grocery store, I have a list. I do not browse. I go and I have 10 things on that list. I'm like on a supermarket sweep, that old TV show, that old game show where you used to go through the supermarket and get specific items. I know exactly where I'm going. I get my 10 items, and I go right to the checkout. I do not browse and say, oh, I wonder what's in this aisle. Oh, that looks good. Not me. I tell my wife, give me a list, and that's exactly what you're going to get. Maybe I will a quick impulse buy sometimes right at the counter. But I don't spend any time more than I have to. I have to get eggs. I go to the egg section. I got to get milk. I go to the milk section. I got to get cereal, whatever it is. Boom. I have a direct route. I don't go through every aisle and just kind of browse around. And that's not the way I am at a department store either. Or when I go online, I know exactly what I want when I go online. I go right to the, now with online shopping, I go right to the website that I know that I want. I go right to the category. I go right to the item. I find it, I hit click, and we're done. No browsing. The word browser for a computer does not apply to me. But anyway, so that's where this whole kind of Black Friday, I think, really started, was from, it maybe had its roots in the Cabbage Patch Kid phenomenon, where retailers saw how people will go out of their way and they will stand in line for a luxury item. You know, in the 60s and 70s and 80s, We always heard about communism and the Soviet Union and how people would be in bread lines for food and outside of the stores at the shelves and on the Russian government-owned stores were always bare, and people waited in line for bread and other staples. And yet here we were in the United States with shelves overflowing with choices. But those were necessities. People would wait in line for necessities, right? You need your breads and your milks and whatever. That's what people needed to survive. But when the Cabbage Patch thing happened, I think that retailer said, wait a minute. People would wait outside in line for a doll? What else might they wait outside for? And thus, I think, was the beginning of the idea of these Black Friday sales, which now have become commonplace. And now the Black Friday sales are that's a generic term. And now people in retailer stores are having Black Friday sales in early November. And this is my point. We have steamrolled over Thanksgiving. I refer to Thanksgiving as a speed bump holiday. We drive over Thanksgiving to get to Christmas. We stop for a little. We don't stop, actually. We slow down. And we go over it slowly, but we're going over it. We are not stopping and enjoying it. When you're driving on a speed bump, you don't sit there and linger on it, right? You slow down. You go over it slowly. You do experience the bump. But as soon as your back wheel is over it, you are off. And you are not thinking about that speed bump anymore. And that, sadly, is Thanksgiving. It's a speed bump holiday. And that is because there is very little commerce in Thanksgiving and a lot of commerce at Christmas. And so the retail stores, the advertising agencies have just moved up the calendar on Christmas more and more, as much as they can. We have radio stations now for many years now, especially because the ratings for them are so high. They flip their formats to all Christmas music, usually the first week of November, not the day after Thanksgiving. The first day, the first week of November, most of those stations flip, and they did it this year. I think it was like November 7th here in Chicago, the main station flipped its format to all Christmas, and will go through at least New Year's Day, and sometimes even past that. So, Thanksgiving, sadly, has really gotten the short thrift on this holiday thing. And that's too bad. I always enjoyed Thanksgiving. And now it just seems like it is a speed bump. It's a necessary evil on its way to Christmas. And that's sad. I have some great Thanksgiving memories, or do I? And that's mainly, it's only taken me a half hour or so to get to what I wanted to talk about. But that's what I really want to talk about today, is Thanksgiving and Thanksgiving memories. We always talk about Christmas memories and Christmas traditions. Do we have any Thanksgiving traditions? I mean, the biggest tradition that we may have here in the United States is that there's always football on Thanksgiving. Professional football games on Thanksgiving. But I don't know if those are necessarily traditions that we should be proud of. But do you have any family traditions on Thanksgiving? And if you do, or if you did, do they continue today? If you did have those Thanksgiving traditions when you were growing up, have you passed those on to the next generation? Do you continue to do those within your family, with your brothers and sisters, and then with your children and their children or your grandchildren? Do you continue those? As I said, I have a few memories. I don't know about necessarily, though, traditions. And that's sad. I think Thanksgiving, while it certainly has its roots, at least historically, we believe in this whole idea of the first settlers here in America sitting down with the Native Americans and thanking God for getting them through the hard times of the winter and the different hardships in coming to a new land with nothing and starting new societies and new communities and dealing with different people, both sides of the coin. Native Americans and Americans, or new Americans, I guess, the pilgrims. I don't know. You know, historically, we've always seemed to whitewash a lot of things in our history here in America. Who knows what really happened with Thanksgiving? Did the Native Americans and the pilgrims really sit down at the same table and share food? Or did people really give thanks? That's obviously where the name came from. Whatever the true origins of Thanksgiving are, it is a nice tradition. Even if you take the religious aspect out of it, if in fact the pilgrims, who obviously came to America for their own religious freedom, they felt that they were being persecuted and could not practice their religion as freely as they wanted. That's why this country, as much as we try to talk about a separation between church and state, will never have that, because the original founders of our country came here because of their religion, their belief in God. And many of our early governments were based on the laws of the Bible. And that's why we still have so much of our Puritan origins still remain in the American psyche in terms of our reluctance to talk about supposedly difficult subjects, especially sex and things like that. It's our puritanical nature. You don't see that in Europe. But those are the people that founded our country. So there may be some religious aspects to it, but even if you take the religious aspect out of Thanksgiving, it's still really a nice thought of sitting down with those that are important to you, those that you love, whether it is family or friends, and just taking some time out to spend some time. And, of course, in our history, that was always the time that people spent together most was around a meal. Now, in today's world, with foodies, meals are less important, or I don't mean important, because they certainly are important to the foodies. People have to take pictures of all their food when they go to a restaurant. But in terms of the uniqueness, it was unique to sit around and really have a bountiful table. And for Thanksgiving, for many of us, that was when your mom brought out her good china and her good silverware and her candlesticks. Thanksgiving dinner was always something a little more fancy. Yes, we've always sat around the dinner table, but Thanksgiving was elevated. It was something a little more special. You can always tell that it was a little more special than usual. But nowadays, everybody eats. I mean, before, you know, once I said, you know, going out to dinner used to be a big deal for people, and now it's commonplace. So few people know how to cook or want to take the time to cook. So everybody goes out to dinner now. Why do you think there's so many restaurants everywhere? People know that there's, especially the younger culture now, everybody goes out to eat 5 days a week, 7 days a week. That never used to happen. When I used to go out, when I was a little kid, we'd go out maybe on a Sunday afternoon. We would have, you know, if not, we had dinner at home 6 days a week. That doesn't happen much anymore, especially with younger people. They're out, you know, 5, 6, 7 days a week eating. So the importance of the meal in general, the communal meal in general with your family, has been a little devalued because we go out much more than we used to. And we have nice meals on a regular basis. That's what was cool about Thanksgiving, was because you never, you know, most of the time you had a regular meal for dinner. And maybe, as I said, you went out for dinner once in a while with your family. So it was something special. So then when you had a holiday like Thanksgiving, it was unique. It was special, as I said. You brought out all the nice fineries. You had the nice dishes, and you had the nice silverware, and you had the candlesticks, and you decorated the table with a centerpiece. Now, you know, in the Martha Stewart era, you know, there's centerpieces every day, right? Martha's always telling you to put a centerpiece on your table. That wasn't the way of the world back then. So Thanksgiving at least when I was growing up 40 some years ago, did have this aspect of a special day. And then, you know, you saw your relatives or your extended family and people, you know, now with Facebook and stuff like that, we have much more communications with cell phone. We communicate, or at least we have the ability to communicate with people on a much more regular basis. But back then, once again, you may have called people on the phone, but if they didn't live close to you, there was no FaceTime, there was no this like that. So, you know, with technology. So this was a unique opportunity built into our culture to get everyone together once in a while, to have a nice meal, to have some, you know, to get people together and to either reinforce relationships or forge new ones and make new memories and carry on traditions. Thanksgiving was always special for me because within my family, it was the holiday that my specific family hosted. My mom and dad had Thanksgiving. I'm sure I don't know, you know, how it is in other families, but, you know, we used to, you know, every few of different family, you know, parts of the family would host different holidays. So there was, you know, this part of the family had Easter, and this part of the family had Christmas Day, and this part of the family had Christmas Eve, and this part of the family had 4th of July and things like that, and this part of the family had New Year's Day. My family, my immediate family, me and my mom and my dad, our house was the house for Thanksgiving for many years from when I grew up as a little kid up and through probably my teens. And then as some of my other family members got older, it wasn't as easy for them to travel to our house. And many of them all lived in the same neighborhood, so it was easier for them to just have it in another house where more people lived around. And so then it got taken away from us kind of organically. There was a couple years where some people were sick and they didn't want to travel to our house, and so we went to their house, and then it suddenly just became, well, we'll take it. And I always felt a little sad about that, because I liked having people come to our house and having our house as being the place where everybody congregated, and it was fun, and it was fun getting ready. I always enjoy helping to decorate the house. My mom went to the store and bought some of those bad those bad decorations, and people that are in their 40s and 50s may remember there was a lot of these. There was this one kind of turkey that when you bought it, it was a paper turkey, but when you folded it over, there was like crepe paper that created the different multicolored feathers of the turkey. So it was flat. And then when you opened it up, all this crepe paper, different colored crepe paper as the feathers, and then you hooked it and you stood it up, and so it was like half printed of the turkey's head with the neck and everything, but the back feathers were all this crepe paper. Oh, I used to love that. It was every year. It was like this great revelation. It was sitting there, and it was always there throughout the year. I could have pulled it out in January or in July, but it just seemed like you waited until Thanksgiving Day, and then you unfolded it and hooked it and put it in the middle of the table. And we always started like the night before, you know, getting the house ready, cleaning the house, and I had to clean my room, and my mom, as I said, got out her good china and her good silverware and the candles and all the different plates and all the different buffet things and those different food holders with the little sterno you put underneath and all that. Oh, she had all that stuff. And, once again, we only used the good china once or twice a year. This was a big deal, you know. Had to bring it out and wash it. We didn't have a dishwashing machine. Had to wash it by hand the night before. It was a lot of stuff went on. Of course, you went out and bought the turkey and the thing, so the you know, the kitchen was rolling, and then my aunts and uncles would also bring other foods to augment the what my mom made as well. And we would sit around the table, and you know, people would talk, and you know, talk about when they were, my aunts and uncles and my dad and things would tell stories about when they grew up, and you know, then, you know, people would congregate to different parts of the room, and we'd do some different things. And it was always, I always had fun. I always really enjoyed it. I enjoyed having the people come to my house, and I enjoyed spending time with them. And even though we're going to see them next month at someone else's house for Christmas, Thanksgiving had its own feel because it did have its own traditional food, obviously, the turkey, and some people have cranberry sauce, and obviously the stuffing and things like that. And I had was mostly raised, even though I'm Italian and Polish, I was basically raised more with my Italian roots. My mom's side of the family was not very big, and so I mostly had the Italian influence. But when it came to the Thanksgiving, there was an American influence. You know, for Christmas in an Italian family, a lot of times on Christmas Eve, you have no meat. It's all fish. And then on Christmas Day, you can have meat. But one thing about Thanksgiving, it has its own tradition, regardless of what your ethnic background was. Because on Thanksgiving, in theory, we were all Americans on that day. And so, yeah, there are some staples. So I do remember my mom, you know, I remember going out and buying the turkey. I remember, you know, her putting the turkey in the oven and basting it. And I would look through the little, you know, window and watch the thing cooking throughout the day and things like that, from the defrosting to the cooking and everything. And then they come out and cut it. So there are some specific, you know, I don't know if we had memories. So I certainly have memories of Thanksgiving. And there were some traditions, but I don't know if they were as much as they were at Christmas time. Christmas just seems to have a lot of traditions. We used to play a specific game, like the give and take game. We used to call it gags. A lot of people call it white elephant. We would do that on Christmas. We would, coming from a Catholic family, would go to midnight mass on Christmas Eve. That was a tradition. On Christmas Day, the men in the family, since most of the time we were at the same house, we'd go back to the same house for Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. On Christmas Day, after a couple of days, the men then, after dinner, would go and the house next door, which was also my aunt's, and have a poker game, the annual Christmas poker game. And it was always a great thrill when all of a sudden I became old enough to play in the poker game, because before that, you just sort of sit around and watch. You know, you weren't allowed in the game until finally, I think when I was, you know, 18 or 19, I sort of said, hey, I'm in. I finally used some of the money I had from working at Jewel, and I said, hey, I got a few bucks here. So there was always some Christmas traditions and Christmas memories. But sometimes, as I said, I feel sorry for Thanksgiving. It sort of gets kind of looked over. But for me, Thanksgiving was always important and special because it was my mom's time to show off, if you will, and have and fun and be the host. And people at that time used to enjoy being the host. It was a lot of work, especially for my mom, because it was just me and my mom and my dad. So we didn't have a lot of family living around us. So we had to, you know, she had to do a lot of the work on her own. But I think she enjoyed that because she wanted to, you know, to present something nice for the family. And when we lost Thanksgiving, I felt a little sad about that because I think my mom enjoyed doing that. But I do have one memory from a specific Thanksgiving. And this is where, folks, I do the tie-in. I've been talking a lot for the last several minutes, and now we come to the tie-in. If you remember, I started talking about why do people like to talk to, and where do you, you know, public speaking. Remember all that about 40 minutes ago? Well, here's the payoff. I'm finally getting to it, and I appreciate your I appreciate your patience. But as I said, all the roads do finally lead to a specific destination. And so here it is. So for me, when people say, well, when did you know that you wanted to do go on the radio and do this for a living, or when did you feel comfortable speaking in front of people? Because that is not something that, especially as I said many years ago, was something a lot of people liked to do. It was scary for many people. A lot of people did not like to raise their hand in school because of an answer. They'd have to say it out loud. A lot of people did not like to read out loud. Remember when we were in grammar school and they had you read out loud? Oh, read this next paragraph. I couldn't wait to be called on to read that next paragraph. I loved it. And maybe I just liked the sound of my voice, and maybe some things never change, right? But I do have a very distinct and specific and strong memory of a specific Thanksgiving that I will always, always keep close to me. And it may have actually been pivotal in my development of feeling comfortable in front of an audience, in front of people, talking, speaking. I remember one year for Christmas, I got a tape recorder. And, oh, my God, that was probably the greatest gift I ever got. Maybe aside from electric football, which turned out to be disappointing. But, oh, I got this Panasonic recorder one year, and so I got to talk into that thing, and I would read the baseball and the hockey scores into it like an announcer. I would do impressions, different celebrities, which I still do. That's where all that stuff kind of developed. And this memory I'm going to tell you from Thanksgiving, I think, also played a major part. It was right around that same time. I'd have to think it was probably when I was about, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8. I would say 7 or 8, maybe 9. I don't know the specific year. I guess I could find it some way. But for some reason, somehow, back then, ventriloquism was still a very popular entertainment choice. There was a lot of ventriloquists on television, a lot of puppeteers. I grew up watching Bill Jackson, BJ and Dirty Dragon here in Chicago, which was filled with different puppets. And, there was always puppets on television. There was in Chicago, once again, Garfield Goose and Friends in the Morning, and Ray Rayner would have puppets every so often. But obviously, BJ and Dirty Dragon and Garfield Goose and Friends all had puppets. And then on television, you would see people like Paul Winchell would have Jerry Mahoney, his ventriloquist dummy. And you would see Willie Tyler and Lester with a ventriloquist dummy. And you would see Sherry Lewis with Land Chop. It was a hand puppet. It was a sock. But the grand master of all ventriloquists, and he was older by the time I was even a little kid, was the guy called Edgar Bergen. And if you know who Candace Bergen is, who is now once again on Murphy Brown, Candace Bergen's father was Edgar Bergen. And he was one of the biggest entertainers in the world. And he was a ventriloquist. And he had two main ventriloquist dummies. There was Charlie McCarthy was his main one, and then who was a sort of a sophisticate. He had a top hat and a monocle and a tuxedo. And then he had a cousin who was kind of a country rube, Mortimer Snerd.
Yeah, that's how he talked. Yeah. Hello, Mr. Bergen. Yeah.
And he was very down home, and he had big buck teeth and a straw hat and, a polka-dotted suit with a bow tie. And kind of slow. But he was very, very touching, in his naivete. Of course, they made fun of that. But the character of Mortimer Snerd was always kind of more funny to me and more real to me because he had more of a heart. Sherry McCarthy had a little of an edge to him in terms of the way Edgar Bergen used to play him. Now, the great irony of this is you have to remember that Edgar Bergen, I mean, he used to play, live and perform live. And so, the key to a ventriloquist is obviously you don't move your lips, right? But the great irony was that Edgar Bergen was not only popular in a live setting in theaters where he performed with Charlie McCarthy, but also on the radio, because once again, there was no television in those early days when Edgar Bergen was starting. And so the irony was that here's a ventriloquist. The main job of the ventriloquist is to make the illusion that the ventriloquist dummy is real, correct? That the ventriloquist dummy is talking. So, of course, the ventriloquist's voice or lips do not move. That's the whole trick. That's how you are judged if you were a good ventriloquist or not. Now, in the early days of radio, when they would have radio programs, they would have a live audience and the studio for the performers. But a majority of the people around the country were just listening to it. There was only a small audience that was there for reaction, for clapping and for you know, laughing to get that ambiance for the broadcast. But most people were hearing it on the radio. They couldn't see Edgar Bergen, who was a ventriloquist, and yet they loved Edgar Bergen. For all they knew, Edgar Bergen was moving his lips. How do you become a famous ventriloquist on the radio? Unbelievable. Talk about naivete of the times. That act would never survive the barbs and criticisms of social media today. But back then it was a simpler time and people were just hungry for entertainment, and so they bought it. And I'm sure if Edgar Bergen, and when I actually saw Edgar Bergen later on television, you know, and he was an older guy by the time I became aware of him, when I watched him, his lips did move. Not a lot, but enough to say his lips are moving. But I guess it didn't matter back then. As I said, it was a simpler time. But somehow, I don't know, it was after seeing all these ventriloquists on television on a regular basis on variety shows, they were very popular in the 70s when I was growing up, early 70s, mid-70s, when I was a little kid. So I said, I want a ventriloquist dummy. And so my mom and dad got me a Mortimer Snerd. They had Charlie McCarthy and they had Mortimer Snerd, and I wanted Mortimer. Mortimer may have not have been the more popular of the two between Charlie McCarthy and Mortimer Snerd, but for some reason, I liked Mortimer better. I thought there was more personality to him. And once again, go on YouTube and type in Mortimer Snerd, S-N-E-R-D, and you'll see what I mean. He just looked cooler. He had the big buck teeth and the little hat. And so there I was. I got my Mortimer Snerd sometime in the summer, and it came with an album by Edgar Bergen telling you how to do ventriloquism, how to not move your lips, how to say certain words without moving your lips, or certain letters, because some letters always need you to close your mouth. And so the trick of ventriloquism sometimes is to say a letter that is close to the letter that you mean. And if you say it quickly and you say the word, you'll get away with it. You know, a B word, blah, you always have to put your lips together for B. But you don't say B because your lips would have to close. I'm not going to get into it all because if you want to be a ventriloquist, I'm not going to give away the secrets here. But you said another letter in place of a letter like B. So that, and you said the word, and so it was kind of strange to say it that way. But to the outside world, if you said it fast enough, they knew what the word was, the ear wouldn't catch it quick enough. And so I did. I listened to my Edgar Bergen album, which I still have today, the vinyl album. I still have it. I will never get rid of that. I still have my Mortimer Snerd doll, and many people who listen to me on the radio know that I used to bring Mortimer with us when we would do live remotes, and he'd sit in the studio as well. Still have my Mortimer Snerd doll.
Certainly do.
You know what? When I do that voice right now, you can't see me, just like Edgar Bergen. I'm not moving my lips. When I go, well, you know, Mr. Bergen, like Mr.
Bergen,
you know, you don't say the M. You can't. Your lips will move.
But
even as I do that, I'm so used to talking like Mortimer without moving my lips, even from when I was 7 or 8. But the big thing was, when I got my Mortimer, my mom said, well, I'll buy you this, but then you have to do a skit and perform for the family on Thanksgiving. Now, that's when Thanksgiving really became important to me. boy, was I nervous. And we finished dinner, and I had one of the several skits that was on the Edgar Bergen album, and so that's what I memorized. So I became good at memorizing a little skit, and I was nervous at first, but I did a nice little 10 minutes sitting there in front of my family and talking and doing my little ventriloquist act. And even though it was in front of my family, and they were certainly being kind to me, I can't believe that I was all that good. But at one point, they stopped being my family, and they were an audience. They were people. And I had to look at them in the eyes and do this skit and be in front of them. And I believe that that was crucial in my ability of being a performer, whether it's on the radio here or doing acting like I do, or public speaking, giving a speech in front of a large group of people, which I've done many times. I really believe that sitting there with my Mortimer Snerd doll, my ventriloquist doll, who I still have, and when I look at him, we have him in a room with a bunch of other dolls on a bed in a spare room. I always think back to that one day, that one Thanksgiving, when it was just me and Mortimer up there doing our thing. And I will always thank my mom and dad for buying me that Mortimer Snerd doll, because that really was a pivotal moment, I think, in my development to not be afraid to go in front of people and perform or speak. And here we are today. So for me, Thanksgiving was important not only because it was cool to have everybody come over to our house, but it was also kind of cool because it was that one time when I realized that I enjoyed, I got over the fear of it. And after I got over the fear, and certainly, and even today, before a play, there's always some butterflies. If you talk to any actor, I think they all say that they all have butterflies before. You have to. You should. It keeps you sharp. But you do have to be able to get over that stage fright. And for me, it was Thanksgiving. Probably, I don't know, 1974, 1975, something like that. When I really probably got over my stage fright, or at least understood what stage fright was and how to combat it. And so I will always remember Thanksgiving. It is not a speed bump holiday to me. It's a very important holiday for me. Every Thanksgiving, I always think of my late mom. In fact, when we go to other relatives' house now, I bring a little candle and I light it and I put it on the table in memory of my mom, because she would always be working so hard on that day. And I always want to remember that Thanksgiving was her holiday and our holiday. And aside from that, it was my holiday and Mortimer's holiday.
Yep. So everybody out there, let me just say, happy Thanksgiving. Yep.
And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted right here at WGNplus.com. And don't forget, go to the landing page where you can find all previous episodes of the podcast. I'm Jim Tarano. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. Once again, have a great Thanksgiving holiday, and we'll be back for episode 132 before you know it. This has been Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, from the end of the web to your screen.
Yo. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Yo.